Hey, everybody. Just to pick up on what Rachel was saying, because it's kind of relevant to not only the history of violence prevention, but the presence of this issue in APHA. In 1987, I and several colleagues, in looking at causes of death of teenagers and young adults in the city of Boston, found that homicide had become the leading cause of death in that age group. This was not entirely unique. There were other cities that were beginning to find this as well. So we put together an abstract for APHA on that, on the findings in Boston, on the comparison of those findings to some other cities. The abstract was accepted, and when I came to APHA to give the paper, it was in Las Vegas, of all places, I found myself in a session on teenage pregnancy. So there were three papers on teenage pregnancy, then there was me, and then there were three papers on teenage pregnancy, because I didn't know where to put it. If you look at programs now over the last couple of years, there are dozens, if not more, sessions on violence prevention of all sorts. Youth violence prevention is very present in that. So it's very impressive how far we've come in a couple of decades. But what it also signifies is that in the 1980s, not that long ago, the public health community was just beginning to pay some attention to this. And so it's been an interesting several decades. What I'm going to do is talk about some of the work we're doing at CDC in the Division of Violence Prevention to give you a sort of broad picture of the kind of work that's being done in this area. And then you're going to hear things are going to get increasingly specific. And there's two presentations on cities, and that's where the action is. That's where the really exciting stuff is happening. So I can't wait to hear it either. Now I have to make this go. Now I'm sure none of you have seen this chart before. I only include it because it's really important to remember that the homicide and suicide are the among the five leading causes of death from early childhood through mid-adulthood. I don't know what to call that anymore, so I call it mid-adulthood. And clearly for teenagers and young adults, it's a devastating element in terms of their health and their survival. What's even more important is the number of kids that are exposed to violence during their lives. And in a study that we do in collaboration with the Office of Juvenile Justice, we've looked at the exposure of kids to violence. 60% of kids report some or are reported to have had some form of exposure to violence, and it's variable from not terribly severe to quite severe. Now, on the one level, because this happens so much, one can say, well, what's the big deal? You know, we're all exposed to this. Most of us come out of this okay. So it seems to be, what's the issue? Well, this is the issue. There's a growing body of science that links these early exposures to violence with a whole spectrum of health issues, from health behaviors like substance abuse, smoking, to mental health issues, including post-traumatic stress disorder. And there are some statistics that suggest that kids growing up in violent inner-city communities have rates of 60-70% of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is higher than the rates in people in the military coming back from combat zones. And physical health problems as well. Heart disease, diabetes, stroke, cancer, suicide. Now, a lot of this was kind of blamed on the sort of psychological effects of this exposure and the development of unhealthy behaviors, but there's a growing science base that suggests that there are real biological effects to these exposures. If you look at the brains of kids who are exposed to violence early in their lives, there's dramatic difference in the development of those brains. That's a healthy brain. This is a brain of a child who experienced abuse. The circles are where the temporal lobes are. That's where our centers for controlling emotions and managing emotions exist. And this represents a dramatic decrease in the level of brain activity in those areas. So, and it's not clear that this can be fixed. So even if we provide interventions and remediation efforts for these kids, we may be able to moderate the consequences of this, but these neural pathways may never develop or never develop properly. And what's also important about this is that we also know that the brain goes through another growth spurt in early adolescence, where new neural pathways are being laid down. So one could at least be concerned as to whether a similar phenomenon is happening when younger teenagers are exposed to violence as well. It hasn't been studied. It needs to be studied. But again, it's reasonable to at least hypothesize that there are several points in a kid's life, in a child's life, where these kinds of exposures and stresses can do neurological harm. Now, this is only part of it, because there's now new research in the last couple of years coming out that stress and exposure to violence may also cause changes in chromosomes, where the chromosomes shorten faster than they normally would in the aging process. As we get older, there's material lost at the edges of our chromosomes. They get shorter. That's believed to be part of the aging process, may very well be part of the development of the chronic diseases of older age. This is happening much sooner in individuals who have been exposed to violence. The most recent study I read, the researchers hypothesized or at least suggested that it may cause as much as 10 years of life lost with these individuals. So it's not just health behaviors. It may very well be the biological changes in the brain and the biological changes in our cells that are leading to this higher risk of longer-term chronic illness and chronic mental health problems. And given that it's biological change, that makes a very strong case that we have to do prevention, that we need to certainly provide services for individuals and teenagers that go through these experiences, but we've got to stop it before it happens so that this doesn't happen. Now, in the CDC, we use the pretty classic public health approach where we do a variety of activities that feed each other. We do a fair amount of surveillance. Some of it's very specific to youth violence and violent deaths of various sorts. We do research and program evaluation to broaden our base of evidence. And we do dissemination and translation. And these things feed each other. This is a little redundant, but I do want to just give you some numbers here, since I'm from the CDC, so I have to give you numbers. I already mentioned that it's the second leading cause of death of teenagers and young adults. It's the leading cause of death of African American men. From teenage years through mid-adulthood, it is devastating in the black community. Incredibly important that we not lose sight of that and that we pay attention to it and that we engage the African American community in this effort. In 2007, and these numbers don't change that much, almost 6,000 young people were murdered. That's about 16 a day. I think the last numbers were 14 a day, so it does vary a bit. In 2009, and again, more recent numbers suggest similar, that you know, between 650 and 700,000 young people show up in emergency rooms with violent-related injuries. And in surveys of high school kids, almost a third of high school kids report being in a fight at some point, and nearly 20% report being bullied on school property within the last year. So this is very much a focal part of the lives of a lot of kids. You know, when we used to go into high schools in inner cities around the country and ask how many kids knew somebody who had been murdered, every hand would go up in the room. And when we asked how many had lost a family member homicide, more than half of the hands would remain in the air. So this is part of their lives. This is not, sadly, out of the ordinary for a lot of kids growing up in urban areas in particular. Now, in terms of surveillance, there are really two major things that we're doing at the CDC. One is the National Violent Death Reporting System. That's not specific to youth. It's all violent deaths in 18 states. Well, almost all violent deaths in 18 states. And what this surveillance system does is not just count numbers, but actually look at the circumstances of these deaths so that we better understand them. And for example, one of the things that's come out of this most recently was looking at the circumstances around deaths related to gang activity. And what was interesting about that was there's the assumption made that a lot of these deaths relate to the commerce of drugs. But in fact, what this surveillance system showed was that was not the case, and that the majority of violent deaths had nothing to do with drug commerce and had more to do with interpersonal violence of various sorts, between gangs, within gangs. And this kind of information is really important because it can help focus and direct services, both for prevention as well as for intervention. The other thing that these systems do is help to measure and identify protective factors and risk factors. And these are clearly important because they can shape our prevention work. At the research level, we're focusing on several things. One is that we're increasingly looking at community-level change and its effect on rates of violence in general and youth violence specifically. Alcohol-related policies, like the hours that liquor stores can be open. Housing policies, green space. And there's a pretty good sense that there's a lot of environmental activities that are important contributors to the reduction of violence in communities. And what's particularly important about this is that this goes well beyond youth violence, that this probably influences the whole spectrum of violence. And so is it, as I said, increasingly a priority for us. The second thing we're doing in this is that we're funding six academic medical centers around the country to have centers of excellence in youth violence prevention. They're listed up there. I'm not going to read them off to you. But what's most important about what they're doing is their work is directly focused on in communities where they are working in partnership with pre-identified communities to implement a spectrum of programs and activities around youth violence prevention and evaluate them. And that's in part because we're learning increasingly that there aren't single programs that are going to fix this, that we need to have a comprehensive approach, and that we need to both understand the evidence around these comprehensive approaches, as well as, and I'll get into this in a minute, we have to better understand how to work with communities to help them to, in fact, put these kinds of initiatives in place. So these are not academic centers that are doing esoteric work. They are very much on ground level. And actually, one of the more recent ones was an evaluation of the ceasefire program in Baltimore. Ceasefire program is a mediation program for inner city teenagers and young adults to reduce, in particular, gun-related violence. Now, there are also some very specific community-related activities we're doing. One is STRIVE, where we're working with four cities to actually implement comprehensive programs. We're funding them in part. We're helping them to identify other resources. And we're not only learning through this experience what these comprehensive programs look like, but we really are learning how to do it. And we not only need to know what works, we need to know how to work with and help communities to be able to implement effective programs. And in a lot of ways, the communities are guiding us in this. We're really learning from these communities as we try to work with them to identify strategies. And then the second ground level work is unity, which Rachel referred to. This, in many ways, the providing of technical assistance to communities is the long-term future of our programmatic efforts in youth violence. And that's because we'll never have enough money to fund every city to do this. So we have to figure out how to work with cities, help cities identify resources that already exist. In most cities, there's a lot of stuff going on that doesn't work. And if you can begin to identify the things that aren't productive and help cities to think about how to realign and redirect resources, there's also a lot of parts of cities that have never seen themselves as part of violence prevention. Parks and recreation, sanitation, all of these have a role to play in this because the social and physical and environment around families, around children, around youth are a key element to the level of violence that they participate in and experience. And in that way, if things are aligned and people begin to better define, and parts of city government better define the work they do as related to youth violence, the more we'll be able to do and accomplish without having to constantly find new dollars to do it. So on that note, I will stop and just want to state the obvious, which is that preventing youth violence saves lives, saves long-term health and mental health issues, and saves a whole lot of money. Thank you.